is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 80, and I'm your host, Simon Bowen. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases and other related events. And every Thursday I release an episode of the Past Lives podcast called Paranormal Stories, and that has UFO cases as well as information on evidence of an afterlife. If you want to hear the extended version of this interview, which is an extra 20 minutes, you'll need to join the Patreon campaign. Well, there are now over 75 episodes in the back catalogue. For $5 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $2 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And that's a great way to support the podcast. If you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review and be sure to subscribe. So this week, I'm talking to Kevin Randall about his book, The Washington Nationals, Flying Saucers Over the Capitol. Kevin Randall is a retired lieutenant colonel who served in Vietnam as a helicopter pilot and Iraq as a battalion intelligence officer. He began writing for UFO magazines and eventually moved on to books. He has appeared on countless radio and television programs, and in the mid-1990s hosted his own show on KTSM radio in El Paso, Texas. To prove that he hasn't been stuck in a rut, he has written books about UFOs, science fiction, action adventure, and even a vampire novel called Vampire. Hi, Kevin. Thanks a lot for coming back to the podcast.
Always delightful to chat with you.
So we're going to be talking about your book, which is called The Washington Nationals, Flying Saucers Over the Capitol. This is something that happened way back in 1952, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And I don't really care for the term way back because it makes me sound so old.
Sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
At the time, 1952, the thing about UFOs is not the way it's perceived today in society. It was just flying saucers that had started coming up since 1947, really, wasn't it?
It began to get worldwide publicity in 1947, so you're right there. I always kind of look at the modern era beginning during the Second World War with the Foo Fighters. And this was a phenomenon was seen by both sides in the war, anomalous objects, glowing balls of light, and often the structured type craft. And then we had the ghost rockets from Scandinavia in 1946 that did sort of migrate down into Europe. But the worldwide phenomena really kind of exploded in 1947.
And so what was the public's attitude towards flying saucers, UFOs at that time? Were they scared of them? Were they excited by them?
If you go to 1947, it was, I guess, more confusion than anything else because nobody really knew what was going on. And you take a look at the newspaper articles from that time frame. There's all kinds of theories about what they are, the alien visitation being among the least acceptable. One scientist postulated it was spots in front of your eyes, like you'd leave a darkened movie theater and walk out into the bright sunlight and you'd see spots in front of your eyes type thing. So there was a lot of theories about what was going on in 47. Then the American military, the Air Force, began their investigation in 1948. They concluded originally that it was some kind of extraterrestrial, extraplanetary phenomenon. But the chief of staff of the Air Force says, no, you didn't prove that case. And so then the attitude sort of changed into debunking all of this stuff. And from that point on into the 1950s, early 1950s, the attitude was, well, there's really nothing to it. We shouldn't be doing this. It's a waste of our time. It's all a bunch of nonsense. And Ed Ruppelt was brought into the Air Force to investigate UFOs. And he upgraded the investigation. Created a whole slew of things to be done, subscribed to a clipping service so he'd get stories of the flying saucers and the UFOs. Ruppelt said in his book that they use the term flying saucer derogatory when somebody would ask him about it, and he'd say, oh, you mean those flying saucers? But amongst themselves, and it leaked into the public, of course, was the term UFO, which was more scientific sounding, I suppose. So that moves us into 1952. Well, there's a lot of stuff going on, especially in the United States, but also around the world. I think the Olympics were going on. There was the United States was immersed in a presidential election. And then we had this vast wave of UFO sightings seen all over the country, but the focus seemed to be on Washington, D.C. because of the sightings there. And they're called the Washington National sightings because radar sets at the Washington National Airport, which is now, I think, the Ronald Reagan National Airport, displayed the objects, and their radar operators were involved, and airline pilots were involved, and military pilots were involved. And it culminated in what I think is the greatest headline I've ever seen in a newspaper. It was in the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Cedar Rapids, Iowa. And it said a banner headline across the front page, "Saucers Swarm Over Capitol." And you're thinking, that just sounds like something from a science fiction movie. So when we get to July of 1952, which is when the Washington Nationals took place, the attitude had kind of shifted inside the military, inside the UFO investigation, into a more serious probe into what was going on. But an overall look by newspapers and the general public seemed to be more tongue-in-cheek than taking the information seriously.
So it was a thing where the military would publicly kind of say it's nonsense, but privately they were quite interested in taking it seriously.
In July of 1947, there'd been a period where the military wasn't taking it seriously either, but once Ruppelt came in, I think he came in 1951 and was ordered by his higher headquarters to look into this thing seriously. So when we get to July of 1952, yes, they were taking it pretty seriously, but publicly they weren't. They were suggesting that there really was nothing to it. It was a lot of nonsense.
And also in 1952, I think you say in the book that Project Blue Book was allowed to kind of deteriorate a bit, so it could barely function. Maybe there was just one person on it.
What happened is, if you have to remember, the other thing you have to remember, the Korean War is going on, and that's a draw on American military as well. And if I'd been Ed Ruppelt and were called to active duty, leave my civilian occupation, I am now back on active duty as a military officer, and I'm stuck with the flying saucers, I'd have been really annoyed. But that would be just me. But all of this was draining on the military, so that they were having trouble manning everything they needed to do. Ruppelt, I believe, left soon after the Washington National sightings. And the project did degenerate to, I think, a single officer, maybe, and eventually to, I think, an enlisted man, before it was kind of revitalized in 1953.
And was he a good man? Was he, like, really into it and very interested in trying to do the best job?
Ruppelt was trying to do a good job. He was the one that instituted a lot of the changes to Project Blue Book. And when he joined, it was Project Grudge, and then evolved into Project Blue Book. But like I said, started a clipping service. And he said that in the beginning, they would get the clippings, the UFO sighting clippings, in just a regular business size envelope. And then it became a little bit larger envelope. And then it became a larger envelope. And then started getting them in a shoebox full of clippings so that you could see the wave of sightings growing from early 1952 into July of 1952. But Ruppelt was serious about trying to investigate the sightings and trying to get some kind of answers. That would have been what he was told to do by a number of his superiors, was to kind of revitalize the investigation and find out what's going on. Once he left, and his tour of duty had ended, so he left that occupation, the manning of the office deteriorated. And then in January of 1953, you had the Robertson panel, which was sponsored by the CIA. And their attitude was that there was nothing to this, and that teachers should not allow children to read books about flying saucers because it did no good. And any book reports or projects on flying saucers should be rejected out of hand. Disney should be contacted to create some kind of a anti-saucer film. And the man that was brought in to replace Ruppelt eventually was rabidly anti-saucer. He thought there was nothing to it. And I think he was probably really annoyed about the assignment. And so it deteriorated back to where it was prior to Ruppelt coming in. And it kind of remained that way until Robert Friend came in at the end of the 1950s. He did what he could, but wasn't a whole lot. And then we move into the 60s with Hector Quintanilla And it was basically public relations at that point, as opposed to real authoritative investigations.
And so in 1952, before the Washington Nationals happened, the Lubbock Lights happened, didn't they? So what happened with the Lubbock Lights?
The Lubbock Lights took place in August and September of 1951, and Rupert was involved in that investigation. And what it involved was a number of college professors at Texas Tech University now. I guess it was Texas Tech College at the time. It was a college as opposed to a university at the time. The difference being a university, and I'm not, for those of you who may not understand the American educational system, a university does graduate, has undergraduate and graduate degrees. They can programs, and a college just has the undergraduate program. So these guys were working at the college, which evolved into a university, and they saw these lights fly overhead. And it kind of surprised them. They didn't know what it was going to do. And they discussed amongst themselves, what would they do if they came back? And lo and behold, they came back and they made a number of observations. They called the local newspaper and talked about it. And that kind of sparked the investigation. Then on at the end of August, a guy named Carl Hart Jr., he was 19 years old at the time, photographed the objects as they flew over. And there was great controversy about that. Rupel went to Lubbock to interview Hart a number of times about that. They sort of read him as right, saying, well, if this is a hoax and we find out, you're going to be in big trouble. But if you tell us now it's a hoax, then you know everything is cool and we'll just go away. And he maintained that he didn't know what he'd photographed. Later on, the Air Force investigation determined it was birds, migratory birds. And there were some sightings that really were birds. There's a bird called the plover, which has a white breast, and it would reflect the lights, and you would see that at night, but they never flew in formations, and you never saw a flock larger than seven or eight. And here we have the Lubbock Lights in a V-shaped formation going on at the time. And that's what Carl Hart Jr. Photographed. I did talk to Hart in the mid-1990s. I was in Lubbock doing the Roswell investigation. Part of the Roswell investigation took me to Lubbock. And on a lark, I looked his name up in the Lubbock phone book, and it was there. And so I gave him a call, which probably surprised him. And we chatted for a while. And I know that frequently when a teenager fakes a UFO sighting, and there's been lots of those done, in like about 99, in those days, back in those days, the 1950s, about 99% of the photographs were taken by teenage boys. And 99% of those were faked. So there was a real belief that was fake. But I talked to Hart in the 1990s, and he was in his 60s at that time, and we chatted about that. And I asked him what he photographed. He said, I still don't know. I think he was leaning away from the idea it was some kind of alien spacecraft, but he made it, he just didn't know what he had photographed. And I had kind of pushed him on the idea that, you know, nothing's going to happen now, nobody cares, let's get it out. But he maintained that he photographed some kind of an anomalous phenomenon flying over Lubbock. So the Air Force explanation does not work on the Lubbock Lights. There were multiple sightings by multiple witnesses over a period of a few weeks in the Lubbock area and around that part of Texas, the Panhandle of Texas. And they would become the Panhandle of Texas. That area, Lubbock, would become famous 5 years later in November of 1957 with the Leveland sightings, the Leveland landings, and vehicle interference. But the Lubbock Lights, the Air Force just has written it off as birds, and it just does not make sense. Ruppelt, in his book, The Report on Unidentified Flying Objects, maintained at the end of the Lubbock Lights chapter that he knew what the solution was, that he had talked to a professor or a scientist who told him what it was, but he didn't want to give the name because that would reveal who the scientist was, and he didn't want him ridiculed by having an association with flying saucers. In Ruppelt's private notes, which were by a number of people, I think they ended up at NICAP, and I think they're now at UFOs. But in his private notes, Ruppelt identified the explanation as fireflies, which makes no sense either. I don't know why Ruppelt would have gone in that direction, especially with fireflies. I mean, it's a flashing light. It's not a steady light. So it really didn't make any sense, but that's where that went. So the Lubbock Lights remain, to my mind, unexplained. It does not necessarily mean it was alien spacecraft, but it means it's unexplained. We do not have a good terrestrial explanation for the Lubbock Lights.
And in the photographs, they look very bright, like they're self-illuminated. It doesn't just look like they're reflecting the light from some street lights.
Well, the Air Force pointed out that they had just put mercury vapor lights in parts of Lubbock. They just did installed those and got them working, and they give off a blue-white light. And some of the descriptions was of a blue-white light, but it would have to reflect from something. And they needed a migratory bird, or a bird that flew in V-shaped formations over the city. And at the time, August and September, their only migratory birds flying in that area were a duck. And I forget the name, the proper name of the duck, but it's got a very dark breast, so it wouldn't have been reflecting the lights. The plover could reflect the lights on its white breast, but as I said, they didn't fly in formations, but the Air Force was satisfied with that. So migratory birds were out. I talked to one of the date guys on migratory bird patterns and got a lot of information from him about it. And that was where I learned that there were no migratory birds in the area, or would be in that area during that time frame, that would have reflected the light. So the light reflection off the birds is kind of out of play, as far as I'm concerned. It just doesn't, the facts don't support it, I guess is where I was going.
Yeah, it's like the people aren't really trying to do a good job. It's like they're just trying to dismiss it and then move on.
Precisely, and that's what happened. I think Rupert was trying to do a good job, and the majority, not the majority, but a good portion of the unidentified cases were during 1952 and Rupert's reign as Project Blue Book. I think there's 702 unidentified cases in the Project Blue Book files, and 303 of them, or something like that, were from 1952. The other problem is, I made a brief survey of the Project Blue Book file explanations, and more than 4,000 are labeled as insufficient data for a scientific analysis, which means simply there is no explanation, but they're not labeled as unidentified, which in essence they are. And insufficient data may be a proper category for some of the sightings. They didn't have what they needed to conduct a proper investigation, but I think they used it as a catch-all. We get kind of stumped here, well, they'll throw that out. And there were a couple of cases where people challenged that explanation, and they changed it eventually. But in the summer of 1952, they were trying to do a good investigation. And later on, if you go through the administrative files and you look through that material, you discover that there's not a lot of activity about moving Project Blue Book out of ATEC, Air Technical Intelligence Center, which gave it some prestige, to the Public Affairs Office, which would remove some of that prestige. And eventually that took place, so that the press release, the information came from the Secretary of the Air Force Office of Information, as opposed to ATEC and Project Blue Book.
And this idea of saying that there's not enough information for a proper investigation almost sounds to me like they're saying, well, we know it's definitely not interplanetary or anything like that. We just haven't got enough information to prove it. It's like they've already got their conclusion before the investigation.
There was a lot of that going on. And I think there was a case from 1967, Austin, Texas. And the guy reported, I think it's Ray Rossi, I think his name was. And he had seen something early in the morning, was in sight for about 10 minutes, got a good look at it, called the Air Force. Lieutenant named Foreman came out. They filled out the Air Force form, and Rossi kept asking, what's the status of my report? And they finally said, it's insufficient data for scientific analysis. And he wrote them a scathing report. He filled out the form again, which was unnecessarily complicated and confusing. He filled out the form and said, I do not understand this, because all the information you needed was there by the detailed investigation by Lieutenant Foreman. You know, you got the location, you got the times, you've got the distances, you've got descriptions of the craft, and all of that sort of information. And the Air Force then reevaluated the case and said, it labeled it as unidentified. It's one of the last unidentified in the Project Blue Book files. But the point simply is, they had thrown it into the insufficient data case, insufficient data file, I suppose I should say. And when challenged, they did change it to unidentified, but it kind of underscores this idea that they did sort of the lip service to the UFO investigations, and then they would just label to get it out of their hair, and it didn't really care that much about it, which explains the Lubbock Lights being a birds, and the Leveland case where you've got literally dozens of witnesses, and the sheriff said hundreds of them. The objects seen on the ground, it left burn traces, it left installed car engines, and the Air Force wrote it off as ball lightning, a phenomenon that they still argue about whether it exists or not. And so we're explaining the unidentified flying saucers or the unidentified objects with a phenomenon that even science is debating about. And so we see that progression throughout the entire Air Force investigation. But you're absolutely right. They just were labeling these things to get them out of their hair. They weren't conducting investigations. There was another one late in the Project Blue Book files, and I don't remember all the details because it's such a crummy case, but the major who was called on to investigate it, in his report, you can see he is just furious about being called in to investigate a flying saucer. He's just outraged by it. And so his own bias, of course, shows up in this, and he's explained it, I think, as a kite and weather balloons type thing. And I'm not sure that's a legitimate investigation or a legitimate explanation, although it might be, but his bias sort of colors the investigation. So you wonder just exactly what was going on there. But yeah, there's that kind of thing that you can find in the Blue Book files all the time.
And one of the things that confuses me about this is if people are continually reporting craft moving around the skies that seem to be able to come and go as they please, surely the military should be really worried about that and really want to find out what's going on. But they just, like you say, they just couldn't be bothered with it.
Well, I think the thing is, we look at the aspects of the investigation, the Air Force investigation, as what we can see. And there's all kinds of classified things going on that we do not get to see. And sometimes that stuff leaks out and sometimes it doesn't. And so that kind of hides the investigation. But in 1969, well, actually in 1967, the Air Force solicited a number of universities to do a study, a scientific study of UFOs. And a number of universities turned them down. The University of Colorado said they would do it. I think they got a grant for $500,000, which, of course, was real money. And it later got another $50,000 to do their investigation. But prior to the investigation, a guy named Hippler, an Air Force lieutenant colonel, wrote to one of the project directors, a guy named Robert Lowe, and said, here's what we want you to find. We want you to say some positive things about the Air Force investigation. We want you to suggest there's no evidence of extraterrestrial visitation. And we want you to suggest the Air Force should stop wasting time and money on these investigations. And if we don't get this now, it's going to be another 10 or 20 years before we can get this thing shut down. This is before the investigation. When the investigation is ended, what do we find out? Well, the Air Force did a good job. There was nothing of scientific value to be learned from further investigation, and they should shut the thing down. I mean, the conclusions were sent to the University of Colorado studies and Dr. Condon prior to the actual investigation. And if you take a look at some of the studies they did, and the one that cracked me up was a sighting that took place in 1954 by an airline crew heading from London to New York, I believe, was the direction they were going, and they saw this strange phenomenon. Well, the Air Force investigated, or the Condon Committee investigated, and they determined that this was a natural phenomenon so rare it had never been seen before or since. And I'm thinking, doesn't that kind of contradict your idea that nothing of scientific value could be learned by further study of UFOs? Even if we learn that all the sightings are natural phenomena, we've got one here that you say is so rare it's never been seen before or since. Wouldn't there be some value in investigating that in greater depth? The Leveland case, which involved, as I said, literally dozens of witnesses, Air Force investigation, stalled cars, landing traces, all the things you'd want. I outlined all this in a book that I did, cleverly called Leveland. laid all of that stuff out. The Condon Committee devoted, I think, two sentences to the Levelland case, saying, well, we couldn't find anything. We couldn't get a hold of the cars because it's been 10 years, and so we couldn't do any investigation of the cars to see if there was any kind of electromagnetic influence in the metal or anything like that. We couldn't find the cars. And then they said they could think of no phenomenon which you would use electromagnetic phenomena that would suppress a car engine. And then when you remove that influence, the car engine would spontaneously start. I think the Japanese in the Second World War had developed a weapon that could stop an engine, but it was only good for a range of like 10 feet. So it wasn't of much use to them. But the point was that the Condon Committee says, we can think of nothing that would cause the car to spontaneous start once the field is removed. Well, I got to looking at the reports, and I think I probably looked at 550 different reports from people who'd done that. Mark Roderick had done a massive study of vehicle interference, and I had access to a lot of other information or searched out other information. And what I discovered is very few of the people reported the car started spontaneously. What they reported was, in fact, that once the UFO was gone, the car could be started. In other words, they took some action to start the car. It didn't start spontaneously. In Levelland, I think one guy did claim it started spontaneously, but the others, good evidence that the car, they had to start the car once the field was removed. So the point simply is we've dealt with these sorts of things. We've got good evidence, and yet we still are having the same arguments today that we had 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 50 years ago.
And so if we get onto the Washington Nationals, you say in the book that these sightings were predicted by a scientist who talked to Ruppelt about it, but it wasn't specifically saying exactly what happened, but he kind of said they're going to show up soon over Washington or New York.
Well, I think that the prediction was, and I think it was based on the trend. He was reading the trend. So you as I said, you know, Ruppelt was talking about where he had subscribed to the clipping service, and the stuff came in a regular, you know, letter envelope. You know, you get two or three clippings, and then it started to grow. So I think he was reading the trends and said that there would be some spectacular sightings somewhere. And if you're looking at UFO phenomena, you got people talking about flying saucers, which they were doing before the Washington Nationals. There was the newspaper articles started to appear frequently, especially nationally. So you've got people outside looking. And when people go outside and look up into the sky, they see things they can't understand. We're more sophisticated today, so we understand some of these things, but people still report Venus. I got a guy called me one night and said he just saw a UFO fly over our town. And I said, yeah, I saw it too. It's called the International Space Station. They'd announced it on the news, you know, if you go out and look at this time, you'll be able to see it go over. So I went out and looked at that time, and I saw it go over. And like 10 minutes later, this guy calls me about the flying saucer, meaning that we're just a little bit more sophisticated, but we still make the mistakes. In 1952, it was even worse. But you have people out looking, and they know who to contact. If, you know, you're out there and you see something and you haven't read anything in the newspapers and you think, well, I saw this strange thing, who do I call? And if as the sightings continued to grow and newspapers reported, then they found out who they should call. You know, report it to the Air Force, or report it to your local law enforcement, or report it to the newspaper. And so that, I think, contributed to the growth of the way. So I think the scientist was reading the trends in that respect. But and you would expect to see spectacular sightings over populated areas, because that's where the majority of the people live. I mean, out you get one or two guys out in the country, and who cares? But you get over a populated area, you have dozens of witnesses. What happened with the Washington Nationals? They spotted the things on radar. They saw them on radar. And they called airline pilots and said, there is an object or there is something on the scope. Here, can you see that and give them a direction? They say, yeah, we have it in sight now. And so you've got radar confirmation of the sightings, and it's not the pilots seeing the things, it's the radar spotting them, and then they're called the pilots. Eventually, they called in the Air Force. The Air Force attempted to make intercepts on the things. And once the fighters showed up in the area, all the UFOs seemed to disappear from the scopes. On the second Saturday night, into Sunday morning, When it happened again at the same location, Washington National Airport, the radars there. Radars at two other locations also had the object on the scope, and they're all talking to one another. The radar operators in the various locations are talking to one another, saying, yes, I've got that going on too. And there was they got the fighters in there. And I talked to both Dewey Fournet and Al Chop, and they were in the radar room the second night this happened. And I don't remember who I talked to first. But he said, well, there was one sighting that got very hairy. And I said, what do you mean? I said, well, I just don't want to talk about it. You know, he thought it might still be classified or something like that. I called the other one, maybe Dewey Fournet, maybe Al Chop. And we were talking about this, and I said, yeah, I understand there was a sighting. It was pretty gory at the place. And so he told me all about it. So I got all the information. But it was a fighter that seemed to get surrounded by the UFOs. And I think the radar in his fighter also picked him up, which means it's a solid object. The Air Force then held a press conference in the days that followed this. It was the largest press conference that had been held by the United States military since the Second World War. And they determined that what was seen were temperature inversions. And this is a layer of warm air over a layer of cold air. So you get a refraction of the radar beams, for example. It's like putting a pencil in a glass of water, and you know how the pencil is bent. The same sort of thing, so that the radar beam would be refracted and would pick up something else, and maybe a moving target. But I'm thinking, yeah, but if you've got the pilots seeing it, and you've got people on the ground seeing it, that kind of rules out your temperature inversion nonsense, because a temperature inversion isn't going to create an object or glowing light or anything like that. Temperature inversion will bend the light rays or the radar beams slightly, but it's not going to put an object up in the sky for people to see. And there's a lot of people on the ground reporting this thing. So you've got that. But the Air Force conclusion, like I said, was a temperature inversion, and that explained all the sightings. But according to Fournet, according to Chop, who I talked to, I mean, talked to both those guys. They didn't know what they were seeing, but it was very unusual for them. Chop was the Pentagon liaison officer on UFOs, or public affairs guy on UFOs. And Fournet was the liaison between the Pentagon and Project Blue Book, the UFO liaison guy. So Major Fournet was a military officer, and Al Chop was a civilian reporter working in the Pentagon.
And so all this happened over two different weekends, didn't it? And it was substantial. There were these different radar sites picking it up, so it couldn't have been a glitch on the radar. And commercial pilots saw them, military pilots saw them, people on the ground saw them.
Military officers on the ground saw them. People in the radar stations went outside to look and saw them. People in the control tower saw them. But the thing about the 1952 sightings is these were the spectacular sightings at the Washington National Airport, because you had all these chains of evidence. But there were other sightings going on around the country that were equally interesting. It just didn't have the various chains of evidence, and it didn't have the multitude of witnesses. But there were people, there were pilots trying to intercept these the objects. There were good sightings of people on the ground seeing the objects. For I always limited, say, if you didn't look at it for more than a minute, you probably didn't get a good enough look at it to really kind of determine what was going on. So I would eliminate a sighting. Well, it was in sight for 10 seconds. Well, it's not really quite long enough to see this sort of thing. So I kind of eliminate those. But there was just a multitude of sightings. And as I said, there were more than 300 sightings that were labeled as unidentified in that time frame, and involved just people from all walks of life. And the other thing you got in that time frame was the idea that the people seeing UFOs weren't very well educated. They weren't very sophisticated, and they might have been drunk at the same time. And when you look at the reports, what you find out is that the higher the level of education, the longer they got a chance to look at it, they were completely sober, the more likely that case was going to be of high strangeness. And so you're looking at that. And I think it was Hynek that had a scale on the strangeness of the case and the credibility of the witness based on educational background, job experience, that sort of thing, and giving it a level of credibility based on the person who made the sighting. And so you get some high strangest sightings with high credibility sightings in that time frame, which just impossible to to solve. And Washington Nationals being among those, but there were cases from Edwards Air Force Base where they're doing experimental. That's where they were testing experimental aircraft. So those people were well aware of what was going on in the sky around them, and they're making sightings as well. You've got military sightings. You've got scientific personnel, people with scientific backgrounds, you know, seeing these things. So it's a wide range of witnesses from one end of the spectrum to the other.
And the objects moved in a way that was beyond human technology, didn't they?
There were sightings where they seemed to make almost 90 degree angle turns at high speed, which would have crushed a human pilot because of the G forces. I think the fighter pilots, the very fittest of the fighter pilots, the guys in the best shape, guys and gals, can stand a force of about 9 G's without losing consciousness. Average person's probably 5 or 6 G's. You lose consciousness. You get much beyond that, it's going to kill you. And these things were making turns that would suggest G forces in the hundreds, which would have basically flattened any human unless there's some kind of protection inside the craft. So the technology, because of the way they would accelerate, the way they would make turns, the way they would stop, suggested high G forces being on the objects. And that would have killed any crew inside unless they've got the technology to kind of mitigate those sorts of forces.
And it seemed like the UFOs knew what was going on in the sky, because I think you said that the two of the F-94 jet interceptors, they were scrambled, they went up there, and the UFOs disappeared.
Yes, that's what both Fournet and Chop told me, that when the spiders showed up, the UFOs on radar screens would disappear, and they didn't always see something. There were sightings where the fighter pilots did see that, but when the fighters showed up, especially on the first night, all the anomalous blips on the radar scope seemed to fade away, and once the fighters left the area, then the UFOs returned. And these sightings took place over a period of hours and ended about dawn on the next morning. So they'd start at what, 8 or 9 o'clock at night and run until dawn. Now, not every radar scope was involved the whole time, but there were periods when some scopes had nothing and other scopes did. But there were periods when all the scopes had the objects on it. And in at least one case I know of, the fighters. Radar also displayed the object. So you've got the civilian witnesses on the ground, you've got military witnesses, you've got the instrumentality in the sightings. The only thing we don't have, which is unfortunate, and there may be gun camera footage from the fighters, and I say that speculative. I have not been able to find anything like that. But some of the fighters may have been equipped with gun cameras, and if so, there might be gun camera footage of the UFOs, but no legitimate photograph from the 1952 Washington Nationals has ever surfaced. And you have to remember, this was a time where not many people had cameras, or they had very inexpensive cameras, and film was expensive, and development was expensive, and, you know, they're shooting lights in the sky. And the other thing is, the film wasn't all that sensitive, so it may not have registered on the film. So people who took photographs got a black frame because nothing was bright enough to show up on the film that they were using. So there were a lot of problems like that, but there's no legitimate photographs. And I think the answer lies in the technology and the financial situation of the time. Unlike today, where we all have spectacular cameras, you know, security cameras on your house that are showing meteors falling and things like that. So the fact there's no photographs doesn't really bother me all that much. But there was the multiple chains of evidence, and there was a lot of people seeing a lot of things that they were reporting. Airline pilots, military officers, military personnel, civilians, on the ground, civilian airline pilots, all of that sort of thing going on.
And was there a thing where the civilians who are seeing things and the civilian radar operators got quite frustrated by the lack of response by the military?
I think, you know, There's a lot of one of the problems going on in Washington at the time is Andrews Air Force Base had been closed. They were resurfacing the runways. So the fighters had to come from, I think, Dover Air Force Base. So when they were calling in, the first night especially calling in, that the Air Force was not inclined to respond. And they had to get permission from, the request had to work its way up the chain of command. And there was not a lot of enthusiasm for passing the messages on. When you get to the second night, then you get a little bit more enthusiasm for checking these things out. And we had a military officer in the radar room at the time. So that added a note of credibility as to the military thinking on that. So you did get the response. But again, it was slow coming. And I think, again, it's because they needed to get permission to scramble the fighters. And it had to work its way up the chain of command and then back down to the fighter base where the aircraft were located. And it took a little bit of time.
Sounds quite cumbersome. I mean, if it was the Russians coming over and some bombers, they'd want to be able to react faster than that, wouldn't they?
But the difference is they would have known the Russian bombers were coming sooner. They wouldn't have just appeared over Washington suddenly. There would have been alerts. There were any number of radar fences protecting the United States at the time, and I'm sure that depending on the route taken by the Soviet bombers, that there would have been notifications in Europe that something's going on. And so the response would have been a little bit different, but you still have the problem with the chain of command. But I think there would have been hints about it being Soviet, and the way the things appeared over Washington, D.C., there were no hints. They didn't know what was going on. And I think that's part of the confusion as well. They didn't know what was going on. They've got reports of lights in the sky, and they've got reports of blips on the radar screen, but they don't have anything that suggests any hostility. And so they were a little bit reticent in responding to the calls, but they did respond eventually. And there were other problems going on, like I said, that with Andrews Air Force Base and having to get them from farther away. The fighters from farther away, I should say.
And were the UFOs seen in the vicinity of the White House?
It got President Truman's attention, but I think if they'd gone outside, the sightings were all over the Washington, D.C. area and Virginia and Maryland. At the same time, there were people in other locations that saw the saw UFOs and reported them. So, yes, you've got sightings not only in Washington, D.C. at the airports, but you've got it all around the Capitol as well. So there's a lot of sightings going on around there. Some of them are the result of people misidentifying natural phenomena, and some of them are the result of seeing something they couldn't identify.
So you talk about Harry Barnes a little bit and what he did and his opinion. So who was Harry Barnes?
Harry Barnes was one of the, he was the leader of the radar crews at the Washington National Airport. So he had a lot of influence, I guess, on that. I mean, but he was well experienced, knew what was going on, would recognize the anomalous propagation on the radar scopes for what it was. He'd recognize weather-related phenomena. He was a very experienced man, as were the rest of the people on the radar at the time. And they performed their little bit of maintenance that they could do there to see if, you know, it's kind of like us with our computers today. If something doesn't work out, we unplug it and plug it back in to reboot the system, and then you may have resolved the problem that way. So they could do that kind of low-level maintenance. If something was egregiously wrong, they would have to bring in other people to do it. But Barnes was the guy who talked quite a bit. He was interviewed by Life magazine and other people about the experiences and talked about what he had seen and how it was a very strange situation and something that they had never really seen before.
And he said that he thought they weren't manufactured craft, but he believed the objects were under intelligent control.
Yes, absolutely. He was based on his observations, but I think he said they were solid. He thought they were solid objects, which the anomalous propagation or the weather-related phenomena wouldn't be a solid blip, a good-looking blip. They sort of were fuzzy shaped on the radar scopes because of the way the signals would bounce back from a solid object as opposed to something like a cloud or some of these other phenomena that can be picked up on the radar. But he was familiar with all that. I think he talked about it being solid objects, and he talked about not knowing what they were. So his testimony was very important because he was right there. He was interviewed right after the sightings took place and that sort of thing. So we have to take a look at all of that. And there were other radar operators in other locations that made the similar comments to the Air Force. The other thing is, and I go off on a bit of a tangent here because it's sort of important. There was an officer who had talked the first night about seeing something solid and convinced it wasn't a star. And later on, when he's interviewed by the Air Force, when he said, I was kind of fuzzy and it was starlight. And so at some point, I think somebody suggested that his career would be influenced by seeing a flying saucer. So he kind of mitigated his sighting that way. But Barnes never really did that. I think Barnes talked about how he was convinced there was something real going on out there as opposed to some kind of anomalous propagation.
And was there reports where it was almost like the UFOs work together and they go and swarm over and check out some aircraft, and then at other times there'd just be single objects doing things?
There was a lot of that sort of thing. There was, as I said, the one fighter pilot, I think his name was Patterson. I haven't looked at my notes in this in a long time. I probably should have done that before this morning. But the he was a fighter pilot who said that his jet was surrounded by the lights at one point. So it was like they were working together to check out the fighter plane. But there were other points where they'd see a single object. So yes, it was all of that going on. They were seemingly working together. They were single objects. And then the real point is when the fighters usually showed up, all the objects disappeared. And they didn't know whether they were communicating with one another or their radar showed the fighters were there, and they thought maybe they should, their sensors, I should say, the sensors suggested they should get out of the area until the fighters were gone. And I really don't know how the fighters were armed, but I would imagine they would have had missiles and machine guns. If they're scrambling, it's an alert scramble.
And it's weird that these UFOs, whatever they were doing what they were doing, because it was almost like they were putting on a show in some cases. Like, they didn't have to fly around with such bright lights on.
Well, Philip Glass used to always say if the UFOs didn't want to be seen, they should turn their lights off. But the problem we have, and I've had this discussion with a number of people, we really don't know what alien thinking is going to be. We don't really know where they're going to go with their thought processes. Russ Estes had said at one point, yeah, but they're all sentient beings, so we can operate on that premise that we're all self-aware and intelligent. We can draw some conclusions, but I'm not sure how valid that point is. But we really don't know what the thought processes is on an alien, the alien beings, and why some of their UFOs are brightly lit and some of them are not, and why they seem to work in concert and sometimes they don't. They fly in formations and sometimes they don't. And you have to wonder, what's the point of a formation of UFOs? The Lubbock lights, which we talked about, I mean, there was, 15, 20 objects in this formation. I don't think there was any evidence of a craft, lights on a craft, that the lights were moving independently, suggesting that they weren't on a craft. Although there was a sighting just before the Lubbock lights in Albuquerque where it was just getting to dusk and they could see the lights, but they could see a V-shaped object, a Chevron-shaped object, with the lights. So it's just one of those things. We don't really understand the motivations. I think one of the problems that trips us up is there's so much a discussion of things that are not legitimate, meaning alien spacecraft. We talk about the natural phenomena, and a lot of people just making stuff up and sending out, see what happens, or get their names in the newspaper. So we have to be careful of all that. But I just really don't know why they would be flying in formation. I don't know the point of it. I don't know why they would have lights on if they're trying to remain stealthy, because the lights give them away, unless they don't really understand that we can see their lights. And you know, you go back and look at our planet and the sight capabilities of the various creatures, and some of them are very, very poor and they rely on other senses, and some of them, the visual acuity is very, very sharp, and they rely less heavily on the other senses. So it may be something like that, that their vision isn't equipped to operate in our light spectrum. They don't see the visible light that we do. Maybe they see an infrared or they see an ultraviolet or something like that. We just don't know. We don't have any information. All we can do is speculate.
The reports that came from the pilots and other people in those two weekends, were there reports throughout that year that where people reported seeing pretty much the same thing?
There was a lot of similarity in some of the reports. You know, the craft that were described in similar fashion oftentimes. And that might be partially contamination. You don't get a good look at the sighting, but you've heard about what other people see and you kind of incorporate that unconsciously into your discussion as well. But yes, there's consistency in some of the reports. There's any number of studies that have been looking at the shapes of the objects or the light configurations and that sort of thing. There have been studies of that, or the motion of the objects, something called the falling leaf movement of the UFO. So they look at the patterns in the way they move. So there's been some studies like that, but there's so much data to sift through that you really can't draw some conclusions. And sometimes the information is badly skewed. I was looking for a sighting. I was looking to kind of addressing your question, that the idea that the flying saucer, the circular craft with the dome on it, was an outgrowth of the Kenneth Arnold sighting from 1947. And Arnold really didn't see a saucer-shaped object. He saw a crescent-shaped object. And he described the movement as a saucer skipping across the pond, so it became flying saucers. So the skeptical argument was that that influenced a lot of people in what they were seeing, so they weren't really seeing saucers, but this contamination carried forward. So I was looking for sightings that predated Arnold's that would tell us that had a disc shape to it. And there's many in the past. I was looking for something in the weeks prior to Arnold. And I read a report of a guy in Cedar Rapids, Iowa, who had seen 9 discs on the same afternoon as Arnold, reported it's the same day as Arnold. So he couldn't have been influenced by Arnold's sighting because of the reporting. And so I went to chase all of this down. And it turned out the sighting was not in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. It was in Peoria, Illinois. It was not reported in the paper until 3 or 4 days after the Arnold sighting. So the whole thing broke down. And yet I've seen it reported. Frank Edwards, for example, reported it. And I think Dick Hall in his UFO evidence reported it and gave the dates wrong and the location wrong. But it was based, Hall was based on what Edwards had said. And Edwards just got the stuff wrong. And I think he just got the report from the Cedar Rapids Gazette and just assumed it there, even though the report in the Gazette said the guy was in Peoria, Illinois. So the point simply is we've got a lot of that data out there. We have to sift through it and we have to kind of chase it back to its original source to make sure there hasn't been errors in reporting or misinterpretations of what has been said and what has been seen. So we've got to do all of that before we get that. But there's a couple of charts that have been published about the shapes of UFOs. And I think the Air Force did a study, or maybe it was the Battelle Institute for the Air Force did a study on the 10 most common shapes or the 15 most common shapes of the UFO. So there is some consistency in what they look like. But it's, the other thing I sometimes say, is you've got an aircraft carrier and people don't know what it is, and they see objects coming from it. You can see helicopters, you can see jets, you can see propeller airplanes, you can see any number of variations of aircraft coming off that aircraft carrier. So it may be that there are different craft for different missions. We just don't know. All we can do is speculate.
Well, it's been great talking to you again. We were talking about the book, The Washington Nationals, Flying Saucers Over the Capitol. And that's just one of your books, isn't it? And we can get them all on Amazon, is that right?
They're all available on Amazon. The latest is Understanding Roswell. I think that's the latest. and I did a book called Roswell in the 21st Century that talks about that specifically. Did a book on Leveland. Did a book on the Socorro sighting with Lonnie Zamora, the landing case there, in-depth look at that. And did a book on UFOs in the deep state, which answers the question is, why are they keeping the information secret? I think I figured that out, and there's information in there that leads you to that. all those books are available on Amazon. And my blog is www.kevinrandall.blogspot.com, and called A Different Perspective. And a lot of this information that you and I have discussed and other things that I've hinted to today, you go to the blog and you just type a keyword into the search engine there, like Leveland, and it'll bring up all the articles I've done on Leveland, or Socorro, and it'll do the same thing, or Lonnie Zamora. So I think it's a easy blog to search for specific information.
Well, thanks again for coming back to the podcast. It's been great talking to you.
I've enjoyed every moment of it.
And that was an interview with Kevin Randall about his book, The Washington Nationals, Flying Saucers Over the Capitol. And a great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon, where you can hear the rest of this interview, which is an extra 20 minutes. Just go to patreon.com/alienUFOpodcast. If you join the $2 a month tier, you get an extended episode every month. If you join the $5 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week. And when you sign up, you get access to the episodes in the back catalogue, and they are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. And please check out my other podcast. It's called The Past Lives Podcast, and there are over 270 episodes. And on The Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of an afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. I also release an extra episode of The Past Lives Podcast every Thursday called Paranormal Stories. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the link is in the show notes. And in my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regression. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you've signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is pastlivespodcast with an underscore between each word. And if you enjoy this podcast, please leave a review. And be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening. So there was the press conference, and was that like a kind of debunking exercise for the public to say there's nothing to see here?
I think the original purpose of the press conference was to provide a little bit of calming influence.